your identity is the climate. But that doesn't mean that New York on any given day, like today, could have a wild day of like a hot streak and be like super hot. Now, it's rare. But if it had that, it wouldn't define climate unless it happened many times over and over again. But this probability of that happening is really low.
Hmm.
And that's how I think of identity. Meaning, to tie it all together, I think we're of the mind that weather is our identity. Price goes up and down. All of a sudden you're worth $10 billion, $100 billion, or $100 million, and that's your identity. No, not really. Because these things change a lot.
If you are an Empire listener, hopefully you've played around on chain. And if you have done that, you know that transferring assets across different chains is a pain, to put it nicely. That is why we are incredibly excited to have the Wormhole Foundation as a partner of the Empire podcast, stewards of the Wormhole protocol, supporting over 30 different blockchains and 6 different runtimes. Stay tuned later in the show. We have a cool thing that you can claim, which is a Wormhole NFT just for Empire listeners. This episode is brought to you by Monad, which has not only the highest performance EVM L1 architecture ever built, but also the wildest and craziest community in crypto. Monad's internal devnet is live and public testnet comes out soon. So make sure you join the Monad community today at discord.gg/Monad, M-O-N-A-D, Monad. This episode is brought to you by Shardium, an EVM-based smart contract platform with state sharding and auto-scaling. Shardium is designed to achieve horizontal scaling to ensure sustainably low transaction fees for you, the end user. You'll learn more about Shardium and auto-scaling later in the show. Welcome back, folks. Happy Friday. Happy Saturday, whenever you're listening. Santi, what's happening?
Not much, man. Excited for this one. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah. Tell us, so this is the mistakes, the lessons learned episode. You've wanted to do this episode, you know, kind of since I've known you, years ago. And, you know, we've been talking about it more and more and more. And as the cycle came back, you started talking about it more and more. And we're finally sitting down and recording this. Why is this such an important episode to you?
Because it's, I think you focus on your mistakes. And it's one of those nagging voices that you need to at some point address. And if you don't, it comes back and haunts you. And so I think it's, for me, I'm really just doing this episode for myself, because there is no better way than publicly staking stuff. And I'll get into this throughout the episode. But for me, it was, I've been at places where in this journey, it hasn't been easy. And the thing that helped me the most was writing and then publicly like publishing these things in my blog post. That was after the ICO boom. That was a pivotal moment in my career. I think in crypto, it really set me up for everything else that came after that. Had I not done that, I don't think I'd had any reason of success.
Yeah.
So I think I want to do this pod because like, I hopefully people can take what I say here and not make these same mistakes and kind of leap forward and expedite their journey.
What are the, when you sit down and think about your mistakes, there's kind of like two buckets of mistakes that you've kind of shared with me. What are the two buckets of mistakes? And that'll kind of tee up this conversation.
Yeah, I think the overarching message, there's one takeaway of this pod. If you just stop after I say this, you need to understand the difference between an error of process and an error of outcome. And very quickly, an outcome you can't control. And you may think that you can control that. And that's also an error I've made. But the outcome is very random. And you cannot control these markets. Certainly not in crypto, certainly not anywhere else. But you definitely can, and you should focus on errors of process, because you own your process. You control your process. You have full agency over that. And the more that you understand the things that you can control and that you can't control allows you to develop a very robust framework for improving your process and thinking in probabilities and being very analytical. You can be incredibly successful. And it's sort of a blessing and a curse in this space that a lot of people in their crypto journey, like hit it out of the bat. For me, it was like discovering Bitcoin super early. And then Ethereum super early, and you feel like you're this wonder kid and fucking genius, which I'm not. But you can, I think the worst thing I've probably made is obsessing about the outcome. And as soon as I started focusing more on the process and coming at to terms and peace that I can't control the outcome, I think that has been very liberating.
Let's take it chronologically, maybe to start, and then we can get into some of these buckets. So take us back to the very early days when you get into crypto. I think you were working in investment banking. There's probably maybe Bitcoin and ETH that exist back then. Maybe no, it's just Bitcoin. Just Bitcoin. What was the first big mistake you made back in those days?
Probably putting everything that I to my name. Like it sounds great now, but like it's just it consumes you, becomes your life. Like you're distracted. You're like look, I think everyone that's in crypto has a very high tolerance for risk, but I think you always want to do things that make you slightly uncomfortable, but not like completely uncomfortable. And so it was very easy back in the day. Like for me, my mental framework was like, if I lose this, I'll get a bonus next year, whatever.
So what year is this? 2013?
Yeah, 2013. 20.
And so
yeah,
you just took your IB bonus or...
All my bonus, put it in Bitcoin. Like was cost averaging in and bought Bitcoin. And it was like, I don't know, 150, 160-ish or so. The worst mistake probably I did then was like not following through with like what I wanted to do. And that's why writing later on became so important, because as soon as you publicly stake something, like it kind of forces you to do something. So I was like talking about Bitcoin. I was obsessed about it. I was talking to my friends, my family. But I wasn't really like really... Like, so I read the white paper and it was super interesting, but I could have done way more work to like pay attention. But you said in a prior episode, I wasn't doing that full time. And so putting like all of my bonus in something that is not full time was like not something I would probably do again.
So
even though the outcome was fantastic, right? But it was an error of process.
So, okay. So I'm going to push you in this episode to kind of think like actually share like specifics and anecdotes and real things. So you put your IB bonus into Bitcoin, and then do you just sit in Bitcoin or do you start, you know, price runs up and you start trading? Like, cause the big question on everyone's mind at this point in time, first week of March is, do I sell or do I not sell?
I went in thinking this is a long-term venture bet. And then very quickly I forgot about that and was like trading this stuff in and out. And, you know, because, you know, traditional markets, you don't get this type of returns. And so you're like, holy shit, like I doubled, I tripled. Wow, this is great. And that was a huge detraction from my original thesis, which my original thesis is this is a super long-term risky bet. I'm like, assuming it's like, may not work out. The biggest mistake I did there was like not having a price in mind, not thinking, hey, what happens if something doubles, triples, 10x's overnight? Like, what do you do? And I think that's something that I constantly do now. Going into an investment, like I do these scenario analysis of like, what will happen if a position triples in size tomorrow and it becomes a greater share of the portfolio? Like, what would I do then? And because I didn't do that work, then it caught me off guard very quickly because there was a huge run-up in price, as there constantly is in crypto. And then I was like carried away, right? And I was doing dumb shit. And I was trading it. And then once you start down this path of trading, it sort of is a detraction, because then, you know, I remember when Poloniex launched in the troll box, it was like so fun, right? This was like 2014. There's now MadeSafe and Golem and all these other projects. And, you know, you're swapping Bitcoin for these other things and yeah, it's entertaining. But that sort of then became a trader, and I'm not a trader. And so I was, you know, that was a big mistake. Not going through scenarios of what happens if position does X or Y, how would I manage that? And more importantly, maybe the answer is, and oftentimes the answer for me today is, you just don't do anything, but you assume that if it happens, you're going to force yourself to re-underwrite. and this is probably my biggest mistake in the space, was like buying Ethereum and not re-underwriting my thesis as the price went from 70 cents to 10, back to 7 to 18. And like, I didn't like constantly update my thesis. And so that was like very, very distracting and difficult to manage.
Mm. Take us into Ethereum. Then I want to talk about the lesson. So you buy Ethereum when it's what? So do you rotate some of the Bitcoin into Ethereum? How do you think about, like, did you do all of your Bitcoin?
No. I was mindful of the tax implications. So I actually called up my dad and said, hey, I'm investing this thing. At the time I was at a venture fund called SageView, and I was making a little bit more money, actually way more money. And so I had the ability to put more of those earnings into Ethereum. And then I got my dad and mom to invest in this thing as well. Funny enough, I still have this. It's like one of the best things I wrote this email to my dad. I'm happy to screenshot it. And it said, this is the future of the internet. Whatever you're comfortable, 25K or whatever, which, you know, it's a lot, I guess. But this is the future of the internet. This is a long-term bet. And like, again, I failed because then I did all other shit during the ICO movement. But that was, I was lucky, but also at the time I was investing in open source software, as people know. And so Ethereum made a lot of sense. I started discovering the power of writing. SageView was later stage. I wanted to go super early. So I was interviewing at Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins, and they asked me, hey, write a memo about investing in something. And I was like, Ethereum. That was my memo. And I was listening to Chris Dixon. I was listening to Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn founder, and they were paying attention to Ethereum. And I was in San Francisco, so Vitalik was going around town, and I'll tell you what I did very right there. I listened to smarter people like Chris. Like, I listened to him on a podcast talk about Ethereum. I'm like, okay, this is a really smart guy. I then bought a bunch of Ethereum, and then I did also dumb shit.
So what are the big, like, if you could kind of summarize the big mistake from the, you know, buy Bitcoin, then you start rotating into the golems of the world, and then you buy ETH and maybe you rotate into the IC. Like, what is the big mistake and the big lesson here?
I didn't know what the game I was playing. I was an investor, and then I was a trader too, and I wasn't like honest with myself. And I think that's part of the opportunity and the challenge is that crypto is this liquid asset, like liquid venture class. And honestly, it is a great learning from anyone that's getting started with investing. Like, you learn so much in crypto in one cycle, then probably, you know, it's like a huge education. But for me, it was like not understanding the game I was playing. And you mentioned this in the prior episode we recorded, right? You have to know the game you're playing. And it's okay if you can be both. Like, you can try to be both, but for me, it was just like, I think I've done this math, but had I not touched any of the Bitcoin and Ethereum, I would have made probably more money than I have today. No, actually, yeah.
So how does that then impact how you think about today and selling and trading into things?
Yeah, well, I'm sure this is like top of mind, right? As people start making money on memes and other stuff, like, they want to know, how do you sell? There's no right or wrong answer here. And I can tell you what I do and think about, but I would just caution because everyone's situation is different. Like, what I did back when I had X to my name as a analyst and associate is very different than what I am today. Like, I'm lucky because I don't have family and I don't have obligations, but I think it's very, but okay, you can definitely pay attention to certain things, right? When I am seeing it on the timeline now, when people are euphoric, when people think that they can just continue to flip stuff and make all these gains, like, that's just a sign of like, that just, no, it will stop. And for me, I'm okay. here's how I think about it. Every time on the venture side, as soon as I make a 10X, systematically I size down. Because I'm mindful that if I continue to do 10X on everything that I do, I will become the most successful investor of all time. And I will not. Probabilistically, that's not going to be me. So I'm just comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Like that is my process. Like I think in probabilities of, okay, but also like I was very rash in the way I thought about portfolio construction and sizing down and selling out of positions. Now I'm more systematic. And I don't sell, like I'm more thoughtful in how I sell over time. And I'm battling right now with like a big meme position that I have, for instance. People could probably guess what it is. Yeah, it's like it's been like a 10,000 plus X or whatever.
Can we use specifics here? And if you don't feel Whiff, comfortable with it. Yeah, like Whiff. So Whiff is
what it's super early on. It's grown to like 8% of the book.
So you bought Whiff very early, you know, 1,000X or whatever. And so now it's, you know, 8 to 10% of the portfolio. Like how are you thinking about selling out of this Whiff position or selling in parts and using those lessons that you learned in the early days?
So I have a very clear thesis I have I only have two memes. Well, three actually. Whiff, Bonk, and this random meme coin and base, Toshi, I think. But that's irrelevant. It's like nothing. The big ones are Whiff and Bonk, but I put equal amounts in both. It's actually size it with conviction early on. And my thesis was, I'm bullish Solana. This outperforms Solana. Because if you're bullish Solana, then you have a similar thesis with NFTs like Tensorians or Matlabs. Mm-hmm. My expression was memes are easier, more accessible for people. And it's a retail chain. It's the best place for retail. So memes will do well. And Bonk I bought Bonk a bit later. I wasn't as early as I was with Whiff. But thankfully I was paying attention and so I bought. And Whiff has obviously done way better than Bonk. And today I was like, okay, it feels like I thought like if it hits one, that'll be huge. And I had alerts. And then I was like, okay, I should probably sell. And I didn't. I haven't sold any. Neither Bonk or Whiff. And I'm thinking, okay, well, should I take some chips off the table, at least my principal? And I haven't. And it was I was actually battling this morning. I'm like, all right, shit. It hit two. It's down to 160. I'm talking about Whiff. I'm like, all right, time to call it in. Like I'll really regret if I don't take any chips off the table here. But I'm not. And the reason I'm not is because the thesis hasn't changed. You're seeing Solana now at 140. There's a ton of catalysts for Solana. So what did I do today? I woke up in the morning. Sora's used to have back pain. I'm having back pain now. I'm like, fuck, like this is like a sign that I'm like from gods that I should sell. But then I was like, all right, like, I'll do something else. I'll come back to this. So I did some stretching, coffee, whatever. And then I came back and I was thinking, okay, the thesis really hasn't changed. So I'm re-underwriting it. Solana is still, you know, 40% below its all-time high. There are at least 7-8 projects that will airdrop. That wealth effect will have a material impact and will flow into NFTs and memes. If I'm bullish Solana, I'm bullish these two. And then you can do all the moon math that everyone's doing, right? Which is, by the way, none of this financial advice, okay? Like, so like, I'm just like sharing my process, but like, and I'm saying, okay, you know, I think I've appreciated over time that as much as I want to believe the fundamentals matter, one of the biggest things in crypto is really this anchoring effect and the comps, right? There are comps. People are comparing cat coins to dog coins. And then within the dog coins, there's sheep, Shiba Inu and Doge that are like 35X from where Whiff is. Like Whiff and Bonk are like roughly the same market cap, 1.1, 1.3 billion. And I think, yeah, that's so it was a very useful, I guess it's very relevant for this exercise because maybe before I would have just, and maybe this would be super stupid. The outcome I can't control. But I think I focused on my process here, and it's like the thesis is the same, and I think it outperforms SOL. So I'm going to stick to that. Maybe the answer to the question is, what do I do, right? At what point do I start selling out?
Because there's kind of two big philosophies on when to sell. It's either when you start to see the market, you're basically looking at the kind of crypto Twitter and saying, this, there feels like too much euphoria, I'm going to take chips off the table. Or it hits price targets, which are arbitrary price targets that you've internally set. And I'd be curious how you think about those two directions.
Like, I certainly pay attention to the timeline a lot. More so than before, actually. But over time, I've just... I wasn't playing memes before at all. And this cycle is really the first one where I've played them with conviction. Like, well, first of all, institutions really can't touch this, except like probably Joe from Asymmetric. people ask, like, we can get into this fun exercise of like things I've missed, right? Chainlink was one that I missed because it was right after the ICO boom. And like they were announcing all these partnerships with Google. I'm like, here we go. I've seen this movie before. Like, it's probably fake. And a lot of people are like, dude, you should buy Chainlink, you should buy Chainlink, buy Chainlink, buy Chainlink. And at some point I did, but it was too late. Like, it was the difference between like a 300X and a, not a 300X, I guess.
Yeah.
And those hurt, right? Those really hurt, because I think you have to, like, every once in a while, I think you have to get things very right. And when you get them right, they need to be sized correctly. So
that's it. Let's actually move maybe into that ICO era, Santi, because in your notes, you put down ICO boom, not sizing with conviction.
Probably. By the way, did the whiff bonk thing, like, was that clear enough, or is there anything else that we should focus on? I'm actually battling with that internally right now, and I don't have perfect answers for this, because it's like a very, it's difficult. It's very difficult. Like, it's not easy. It doesn't get easier. By the way, it doesn't get easier over time.
Does your philosophy on meme coins change when you have more money now? Like, if you, let's say you did not have as much money, like, would you still be allocating would you allocate more to the meme coins? Would you allocate less to the meme coins? Like, are you more comfortable pushing farther out on the risk spectrum because you have this safety net?
Maybe, yes. Hmm. Although, a lot of people that are like made a certain amount of money don't touch meme coins, because for them it's like, whatever, you know, right. I'm just going to hold. But I like touching meme coins now, because it allows me, I think it gives me a lot of information on the broader ecosystem. And I think you need to pay attention to memes. Xiao's, I've learned a lot from him. I think he's one of the smartest guys out there. He's paying attention to memes. I think you have to appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I think memes for me are, I want to have them size in the portfolio, not 50%, but, you know, a decent amount to pay attention, because I think it informs a lot of, like, the meme coin phenomenon that really started and has been happening in Solana, I think tells you a lot about Solana, of what is working in Solana, the type of people that are coming to Solana, the type of, and so for me, it's, it is important to appreciate these things. And before I was like very critical, I was like, oh, you know, this is too left curve. I'm not going to touch it. I was very critical of Elon, like, tweeting about Doge, and like, now I've like opened up to it and I've become less opinionated or about memes. I actually appreciate them a lot. And so,
yeah,
it's also, an arb, I think, in some ways, because institutions are not touching it, and retail and crypto is a very retail phenomenon.
Yeah. Tell me about the biggest mistake you made related to sizing with conviction or lack thereof, specifically maybe around the ICO era, is when I saw you were writing some notes on that, but I guess it really doesn't matter what time period.
I passed on the seed round for Axie because we had a very small allocation, and it was a mistake because I felt that you take the allocation, even if it's small, even if it's not what you, by the way, really hot projects, like, you're never going to get the full allocation that you want. But take it because it's option value. And it was a mistake.
So you had an allocation, but it was too small to be relevant for the fund. So you guys passed.
Yeah. And then it hurts, because then you don't revisit. It's like, the flip side of that is that then I started paying more attention to gaming, right? Because I was like, okay, this is very real. But I think one of the bigger mistakes I've done and not follow through was, I think generally speaking, the way I think about early stage investing, it's option value to pay attention. As soon as a token launches, like you look at like the comps of Arbitrum, Lido, some of the bigger projects like Uniswap, Axie, there's this like, I think you can run this math, but like there is, you would have done exceptionally well if you bought it right when it listed and like a couple of weeks into the selling of like the early kind of the retail that gets the airdrop and is selling it for like PlayStation 5s. Like that is an example of an idea in a, like a type of strategy that I had, but never really implemented. And now I'm like, it's probably one of the things that I focus on the most, which is there's a lot of, you know, as soon as a project that I'm an investor in that I know well, like is launches it, you know, and is out there. And like, there's this wave of like post airdrop where you have an ability to sometimes even size up the position way more at a price that is not too dissimilar from where you invested. So yeah, that was like true for Arbitrum, true for Lido, true for Axie, true for Alluvium, literally like most of the projects. And I've never really implemented the strategy, and I always think about it, and I always be like, all right, I'm going to do it this time, and I don't do it.
Hmm. Can you say more about it doesn't matter if you're right, if it's not with size? Because this is something that I'm trying to figure out in my, you know, with my liquid holdings right now, is I kind of feel like my book is too big, right? I've got 30 things and I'm like, okay, well, there's a lack of conviction there instead of being, you know.
Okay, so like pause there. Do you believe that, or are you believing that because other people are telling you to believe that?
No, I'm not believing it one way or another. I'm rethinking if that's the right way to handle things, because Chainlink is actually a good example. Like Chainlink to date is my best investment by a country mile, right? A guy next to me pre-Blockworks was sitting on 4chan and Chainlink was all over 4chan. He's like, buy this thing. And this was when, you know, Omise Go, Civic, Chainlink, right? This was mid 2017 probably, or maybe late. I forget, somewhere in 2017. So I bought Chainlink, but I bought the same amount that I bought of Omise Go and Civic and all those kind of things. So I made, you know, a bajillion X.
Did you buy more over time?
No.
Why not?
Because it was growing so much relative to everything else. So let's say it was 1%, then it was 3%, then it was 7%. And then, you know, by the top in 2021, I think it was like Bitcoin, ETH, then Chainlink for me. So I was, you know, but I didn't believe in Chainlink more than number 4, 5, 6, and 7. So
during this time, how much were you doing work on Chainlink? Not just focusing on the price, but like going to Discord, talking to Chainlink, maybe reaching out to the team. Were you doing any of that? You were just checking price.
No, just checking price.
Yeah, same. I've done that mistake. Yeah. That's the issue. That's focusing
very
on
little,
the,
very
that's
little
wishing conflict. On the outcome.
Yeah.
That's wishing on the outcome. And the process here would be like, you re-underwrite it constantly. Mm. No, you don't necessarily need to add to the position. Like your example of Chainlink is an example I've had with 100 positions, like literally most of them. And actually I should have been buying more WIF, way more. I was buying more Bonk. I was like, I was looking through the log. I was like, why didn't I buy more WIF? It's working. Why did I not do it? And so, you know, a mistake that I did literally since November, I guess, December.
Yeah.
And so that was pretty stupid of me. I think, yeah, like probably I've been incredibly stupid of not really every time I, like, it never hurts to check in on Discord and reach out to teams or other people in the community. Like, we talk about community and crypto all the time, but we never actually implement it for our own process. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, and plus a lot of the stuff is on chain. Like, I certainly have made this mistake time and time again, where the amount of time that I spend on the price and looking at that and thinking about that is should be way less, and I should be investing more time on doing work. And, you know, I guess memes are sometimes these memes, like there's nothing, right? But like there's a team, they're nothing, whatever. But I'll give you an example, like synthetics. People asked on Twitter, like, what has been your biggest round trip? It was synthetics. What did I do right there? First of all, Haven, it was Haven, right? The biggest, Haven raised, I think not one of the largest, but it was like a big ICO, and it marked the top. And then Haven was like the last one out the door, and then everything collapsed. And I was part of a big syndicate. So I size it fairly decent. And then it was like, it pivoted to synthetics. But in that process, I was incredibly lucky because they reached out and they wanted to like get my thoughts on some of these things. They probably reached out because we were just a big syndicate and they wanted to get our thoughts on things. But I became quite close with the team. But that was synthetics, Haven, then synthetics went through this, like, look at the chart. I mean, went from, that was like an 800x return.
Did you sell on it?
Yeah, like I did over time. And oh boy, was it, it was difficult to look at. Like Etherscan had now rolled out the price to where it is now. I'm like, oh, I swapped for X amount of ETH. Oh, okay. Yeah. I left a lot of money on the table. But look, was it a mistake? No. The outcome was like, it is what it is. I think at least there I became close with the team and had, you know, a little bit more conviction. But yeah, I mean, again, am I coping? Is it like saying, okay, don't focus on errors of outcome, a coping mechanism? Yeah, like it is. But I think like the key message that I want to impart here is, I mean, investing is like a more of a psychological game than anything. Like it's, anyone can do math, anyone can do net present value, all this crap, cash flow, discounted cash flow, comps. Managing your emotions is the hardest thing. And I think, I mean, we can get into that, but, you know, now or later time, but yeah.
So on the personal side, there was a note you put around farming and taxes, and I don't know if there's...
Oh, yes. Okay, let's talk about that. So again, a big mistake, costly one at that. Not understanding the tax implications of yield, like a yield farming. Like when you deposit your ETH and that ETH becomes wrapped ETH and like Aave or Yearn or whatever, that's a taxable event. And that, boy, did that cost me a pretty penny. Way more than any yield that I farmed. Whereas if you deposit your ETH and Maker in the CDP, it's not taxable. And again, this, the laws may have changed, but back then it was like a big realization. I learned that after the fact. And that was, again, like not investing enough time and energy in the half the battle is optimizing like your tax strategy. And it was very costly mistake. It was very stupid because I could have figured this out. Staking rewards, when to claim, right? Unclaimed versus claimed. It was, it's material, right? And I think as people in this cycle, like, I think you need to have a tax strategy. You have and look, the tax laws are varying by country and incredibly complex, but get a good tax person and understand the implications of, you know, if you have soul and you're, you know, going to use that soul for other stake aid or whatnot. Like, I think you need to understand that, because what you don't want to be is a forced seller at the end of the year, right? Where you realize, oh shit, I owe so much because I've done all these strategies. And sometimes the answer is it's better not to even engage in any of these strategies if it's going to be a taxable event.
How do you think about diversify? Maybe we were talking about diversification. Maybe we can like double click one more time on that. I'd be curious, like, so this is your fourth cycle, I think. How many cycles did it take you to start taking meaningful amounts of capital out of the system?
I only did it last cycle. when I left Parify, and it was like by luck, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we had a very influential conversation. I don't know if I've even told you this, but you know, this almost sounds so idiotic when I bring it up now, but my philosophy was there's things you sell in crypto and things you don't sell. Like Bitcoin, and remember that conversation probably a year ago. It's like, you just don't sell your Bitcoin and ETH. You can trade around other things. You just don't sell your Bitcoin and ETH. And you're like, that's a ridiculous statement. You have to continue underwriting your things. And I was like, no. And I think the reason I thought like that actually had nothing to do with the asset. It had everything to do with the tying crypto to my identity so much.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I'd be curious how you think about both of those things, which is maybe the first is, when do you take capital out of the system? But the second is probably an even bigger topic, which is like tying crypto to your identity and like how you think about that.
Yeah, the best advice I've gotten when I left Parify was this guy called Ken. And I was with him at a summer house, and he's been incredibly successful. He sits, you know, we were talking about stuff, and he said, look, insulate your lifestyle. If you can do it, insulate it. And you want to do that because it will free up your mind and allow you to be more aggressive when you don't have to worry about, you know, paying rent or covering costs for a couple of years. And you're right. Like, it always feels kind of dirty and difficult to take money off the table because, you know, you look back and you're like, oh shit, you know, I've sold ETH at like $1. I've sold ETH at $18. I've sold ETH at $100. Like, if I'd hold on to that, I'd have like more than a couple billion bucks. Like, it's just like, you're like, no, like, you have to stay disciplined again. And it's a probability, like, you always need to think of probabilities. Like, the odds are stacked against you once after you do a 10x, after you do a 5x. Like, historically, people don't make those returns. And I understand crypto is early, but those things, like, there's a gravitational pull back to mean reversion. Like, just there are like a couple of principles in investing that you always have to come back to. Mean reversion is one. And like, you're not as smart as you think you are. And so, like, after, I think, like, to your question, yes, after a certain return, I take some chips off the table. Now, I think I wanted to make sure that I would be in a position now that I was independent to just, the strategy was, I'll take X amount of money out, and with some of that yield in treasuries or whatever, I'll be able to fund all new private investments into crypto. And so, like, that for me, like, building a diversified cash flow was something that I really wanted to have in 2018 and 2019, and I didn't have. Because the worst is having an idea and not having any fucking money. Okay, you can go raise a fund or whatever. No one wants to give you money then and there. And so, like, it never hurts to have a place where you can draw down from when no one wants to touch this thing. We'll be back at a level where crypto's totally out of favor. No one has any money. We'll call it next 4 years, five. What's the probability of being in that situation again?
Yeah, 100%.
You said every leap year. Yeah. So, you know, okay. Yeah. Then you invert and you say, okay, well, then I probably should have a stash where I insulate my lifestyle. You have a family now. You're going to have kids at some point. I don't know. But like, I've been more aggressive in funding and investing and moving quickly and maybe buying this like memes or whatever, like with, because I've insulated my lifestyle. Like, I've just put money away where it's like, I don't have to think about anything else. And now I can just, so like the process that I have now is after I left Parify, like, I want to minimize all kinds of distractions in my life. And I went through this like ruthless process of like cutting things that were just distracting. And again, the best advice was like, just insulate your lifestyle. Having done that, I'll always be forever grateful to Ken, because I think that has allowed me to be more aggressive over the last year and a half, because you can drop, you know, like, no one wanted to invest in stuff. And, you know, you show up and you do have the capital. Like, that's a mistake I didn't want to do, right? Because I wasn't in that position. I didn't have a diversified stream of cash flow in any of the prior like cycles.
Hey everyone, wanted to give a big shout out to today's sponsor, Wormhole Foundation, stewards of the Wormhole Protocol. If you are like Santi and I and you play around on chain, you know how bad the cross-chain experience is today. Well, Wormhole has set out to solve that, powering cross-chain transfers for over 200 different multi-chain teams, including some of the best like Uniswap and Circle. So what does that mean for you, the Empire listener? This opens up a huge number of multi-chain use cases across DeFi, NFTs, governance, oracles, and more. By supporting over 30 different blockchains and 6 different runtimes, including Sui, Solana, different ETH L2s, Ethereum, and a whole bunch more, that means you have now the most powerful interoperability platform at your fingertips. If you're a developer, you'll be excited to hear that Wormhole provides an extensive suite of tools and infrastructure so that you can securely build multi-chain applications. But don't just take our word for it, obviously. Wormhole Protocol leads the industry in all-time messages transferred with over 900 million cross-chain messages. 900 million, that is close to a billion, and that's a big number of messages. As a thank you, Wormhole Foundation is dropping exclusive NFTs. That's right. We got some exclusive NFTs for Empire listeners. Hit the link in the description to claim your unique Wormhole NFT today. This episode is brought to you by Monad. Monad's thesis is simple. The EVM is here to stay, similar to JavaScript and Web 2, but unfortunately, today's EVM lacks the high performance and the scalability that developers need to make certain applications possible. Monad addresses these concerns and these bottlenecks while preserving seamless EVM composability for application developers. There's a seamless transition to Monad, as the Ethereum RPC API allows for really easy portability. And for developers, Monad can support 10,000 real transactions per second with their unique parallel execution environment. And of course, there's full compatibility with EVM bytecode. Monad's internal DevNet is live. Public testnet comes out soon. You can join Monad's journey in two ways. One, go follow them. They're on Twitter, at Monad, M-O-N-A-D underscore XYZ. And also, join the Monad Discord. It's discord.gg/Monad. Big thanks to Monad for sponsoring Empire. This episode is brought to you by Shardium. Shardium is an EVM-based, linearly scalable smart contract platform that provides low gas fees while maintaining security through dynamic state sharding. Shardium's auto-scaling works by automatically adjusting the resources of the system or the application based on predefined rules and metrics. What this means is that when an application on Shardium goes viral, gets big, right, the network reacts by independently adding more active validator nodes from the standby node pool to increase throughput capacity. This does 4 things. It lowers energy consumption, lowers cost, improves load management, and protects app failures. You can learn more about Shardium or even spin up your node at shm.gg/validator. That's shm.gg/validator. Big thanks to Shardium for sponsoring Empire. What are mistakes that you've made on the, we've been talking about the liquid side. What are some mistakes that you've made on the angel side of things?
Oh, I mean, it's going to sound classic, but like, oh, so-and-so is doing the deal. Okay, fine. And then you realize no one doesn't fucking work because it's not even their money. Now it's all my money. So yeah, I have to do the fucking work. I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating, but like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, you know, like you become a bit complacent. It's like, oh yeah, like tier one fund is doing, the deal. So yeah, sure. I'll invest in it. And I think that, and the second one is probably doing deals where I wasn't convinced that I wanted to work with a founder, but I did it anyways. And boys, those really come and haunt you because it's difficult, man. Like,
yeah,
at the end of the day, like you're on call and you have to be there. And if a founder calls you, you really kind of want to work with them. The worst is like dealing with the founder that you just don't really want to work with. And so I think time, money gives you the ability to have that freedom to just say no and take your sweet ass time. I think there's a, so I'll give you an example. You talk about identity. There's two concepts that I want to highlight here. One of them is when it comes to crypto, it's a 24/7 market. It's venture. It's also liquid, so it's a hedge fund. You can be both, try to be both, don't be none. There's, I think, a difference between reacting and responding. Reacting is you see something, you know, WIF is down 20% today. And you're like, oh, you react to that, right? Oh, shit, you know, now's the time, right? It's turning. Then you do all this chart porn and you're like, convince yourself that it's the top and you're out. You're reacting to that. It's like, I think responding requires you to be more thoughtful and go back to your thesis, whatever it was, and process new information, update your probability, do more work. I think some of the biggest mistakes I've done is just when I react and I don't versus responding. So anyways, that was one. Again, if you don't size a position well, if it's too uncomfortable, you're going to react. You're going to be more predisposed to react because it's like sort of a survival instinct.
Yeah.
When you've insulated your lifestyle, when you've thought more closely about, okay, what happens if I lose 8% of the portfolio? It hurts, but it's not like I don't lose my entire bonus. It's not like a hit to my identity, if you will. So I'll tie it then to your question around identity. I think there's also two concepts when it comes to identity. One, I became incredible. By the way, I was in a very dark place after the ICO boom and bust. Felt like I was a total failure. I was depressed. Literally stopped eating.
Why? Why were you so upset?
Because it wasn't my money. It was also my parents giving me some money, like in the 25K for ETH or whatever at the ICO. And I felt that I failed them. I was obsessed with retiring them. I wanted to do that. And I could, but like I didn't lose money. I was up a lot, but it was not the, oh, like I didn't sell at the top. And it was eating at me. And then finally my dad was like, listen, I didn't give you money expecting anything in return. You're an idiot. Go figure out your identity because you're totally lost here. And he just, that to me, it was a moment where I went to therapy. And I've always been a huge believer in therapy. My grandmother's a therapist. I just think it's incredibly useful. And I'm glad that it's now not as taboo. You know, it's this idea of like, you don't have to be sick to go to therapy. It's just nice to be able to talk to someone that are not your friends, not your family. So anyways, I went to therapy and this guy was just like, listen, the first session I had, he was like, who are you? Like, what is your identity? And I started talking about work. I did investment banking with JP Morgan and all this crap. Now crypto, he's like, I didn't ask you the question. Like, who are you? I was like, you don't know who you are. You didn't mention any hobbies. You didn't mention any interests. You didn't mention any passions. Like, you just talk about your work. Like, your work's not your identity. Go figure out your fucking identity. And that's when I started writing. And I think that's like, that was a pretty pivotal moment because that was a transition for me because I started writing and writing helped me order my thoughts. Not only all the mistakes I've done in crypto, that entire journey, and then you start realizing stuff. And then also at some point, you know, pressing send after the first session, I published my first blog post, The Summit. It's on, you know, people can go look it up. And I ran to this coffee shop, wrote it down, posted it. I was like, fuck it. I just need to get out and publicly stake what I think because that will hold me accountable. And that for me was the mechanism to get out of that rut. So I guess tying this identity thing, two concepts that have been helpful for me. One is I think we are conditioned to think that we can't feel a certain range of emotions. If you think that investing is so clinical, no, it's an emotional game. But more importantly, I think we were like, society tries to desensitize ourselves. It's like you can't feel intense emotions. All of a sudden, you can only feel like a narrower range of emotions. I'm like, and I think like the therapist said, look, you should allow yourself to feel the entire range of emotions. Like it's you can have rage. That doesn't make you a terrible person. You can feel sad about something. It doesn't make you depressed. If you're not recognizing the emotions that you're constantly having on a day-to-day basis, they're going to be repressed and then show up in a different way. And I think that was pretty liberating because no one kind of tells you that, you know? And especially not in this world where you're walking on eggshells, you can't really express yourself because, you know, you can be canceled or all this bullshit in woke culture. It's difficult. And I think the more that we are open-minded about this idea that you should be feeling this wide range of emotions, then it's very liberating because, yeah, it's everyone feels like cope and everyone feels despair and all these range of emotions when you're in this world of crypto and investing. Like, of course, the more you realize that, I think the better you will be over time. Like, you have to be in tune with your emotions, I think. And I'll end with this. Do you know the difference between weather and climate?
No.
Weather is, you check your weather app. Weather is that day. Probabilistically, New York at this time of the year is, I don't know, Fahrenheit, I'm thinking Celsius, but like, it's pretty cold, right? It's like, you know, within 8 degrees Celsius, 30, between, call it 30 and 35 Fahrenheit. Weather is what happens in that day. Climate is the accumulation of years and years and years of, and it's hardened. Your identity is the climate. But that doesn't mean that New York on any given day like today could have a wild day of like a hot streak and be like super hot. Now, it's rare. But if it had that, it wouldn't define climate unless it happened many times over and over again. But this probability of that happening is really low. And that's how I think of identity. Meaning, to tie it all together, I think we're of the mind that weather is our identity. Price goes up and down. All of a sudden you're worth $10 billion, $100 billion, or $100 million, and that's your identity. No. Not really. Because these things change a lot. And climate, again, your identity is something that is way more hardened and complex and slower moving. And so, yeah, that's, I don't know if that makes sense, but at least that was useful for me to understand that, because I think structurally, like, you know, it is very liberating when you can start feeling okay about feeling all these kind of other emotions and being aware of them, not necessarily reacting or whatever, just observing them. Like, okay, right now I'm not feeling that great. That's okay.
What is the emotion that, like, what is the worry or fear today? Because financially you're good, right? You shared this thing with me like a year ago. You said, look, I don't want to feel, now that I'm not a Parified, my fear or concern is that I lose relevancy in this industry that I love so much.
I mean, it's something that, because I've been in a place where I didn't feel recognized or relevant. I was at the startup company during actually the ICO boom. I was setting aging. I left SageView because I, you know, they don't want to do crypto. So I was like, all right. And so I got this, I invested in this company. So, and over time I was kind of the chief of staff or whatever. And I was like, they weren't paying attention to anything that I was saying. And I just became, I felt completely irrelevant. And it's the worst feeling in the world, man. It really is. We were talking about earlier in this pod about like certain people on YouTube and comments and trolls and whatever. It's like, you know, people are commenting, whatever it is, at least you're relevant, you know, whether they love you or hate you, but like they're paying attention to you. The worst is like not even screaming, no one like caring about it. And so, yeah, the feeling of not being relevant is really, yeah, gets at you because we're social species, right? At the end of the day. It was a fear when I left Parify for sure. But honestly, the best thing and the most rewarding thing that I've done is this podcast. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Do I ramble? Fucking yes, all the time. We're 40, 50 minutes in, and I think we got another, you know, couple, I don't know. So yeah, I'm not perfect. But it's just very rewarding. So yeah, no, it's not a mistake, I guess.
Yeah. Let's get back into maybe some of the, on the investing side of things. Like, what is the, it's almost a couple rapid fires for you. What is the biggest rug or mistake related to getting rugged that has ever happened to you in crypto?
FTX. I had some money there. I was running the New York Marathon. I should stop running these marathons, man. And someone...
You didn't seem to either be injured or lose money. Around marathons.
Seriously, man. I love it. No, I wouldn't stop running. Yeah, and I came back. I actually didn't even finish that marathon, man, out of all things. Came back to my room and someone pinged me and said, yo, I think like this FTX is really real. It's going down. Like, just take your money out. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'll do it later tonight. And I punted it. But that difference was, it cost me. or I guess it won't if we're all paid out. But yeah, I'll add nuance because I just said that you shouldn't react, you should respond. But sometimes you have to react when it's a matter of like life or death. When there's smoke, there's fire, you know? And when like 3-4 different people are telling you about it, it's like, pay attention. Independent nodes in your information network are telling you that there's something wrong with FTX. Like, there's probably something wrong, you know? Like, listen to that. So that was probably the biggest rug. And I should have withdrawn and I just didn't. So again, thankfully it wasn't like a material part of the portfolio, but it hurts because you're like, fuck, I could have done it. Thankfully, I became hyper paranoid about that and took my money out of Silvergate the next day, all of it. I was like, I don't want any of this. And so, yeah.
What is the biggest paper hand you have ever had?
ETH. Man, ETH, like ETH and I have had a quite the relationship. I sold panicked when Vitalik sold when it was $18 or something. And it came out and I was like, okay, game's over. And it just becomes, my identity was tied to ETH. Like I was thinking that I was going to retire because
very is this one he sold broke. When he sold, did he, is this one he sold it to Novogratz or?
I forget if he sold it to Novogratz. I don't know if that was the time, but there was a big announcement when he sold and it was like around $17-$18. I think Novogratz probably bought before.
Novogratz. So yeah, Vitalik sold a big chunk to Novo at 99 cents.
This was when he, I think he sold. Well, yeah, I guess he sold multiple times, but the one I remember is when it was like sub 20.
So you saw that and you sold?
Yeah, I mean, I was up like 40x or something.
You sell all of it or some of it?
No, I had a decent chunk.
Yeah. So ETH, when Vitalik sold. Any other ones that you've any other ones that you've just sold you where the thesis was right, but and the investment was
right? Dude, I've had this thesis about ETH all the time. And I've somehow done dumb shit along the way and convinced myself that, you know, I was going to do X or Y. And sometimes it works, but again, yeah. Probably the biggest paper hand. I mean, I've done many others, right? But ETH is the one that hurts. I mean, it doesn't hurt, I got to say, because like, I don't necessarily regret, taking levered bets on ETH, whether it's NFTs or DeFi or whatever. But I gave up probably too much ETH and these ICOs and, sold when I should have.
What's the biggest, what's the biggest mistake you've made around you got the thesis right, but the investment was wrong? So, yeah.
Well, it's ETH, right? I mean, it just said it. I'll publish this memo that I wrote to Sequoia about ETH. Like open source on steroids. I have a blog post about it. It's probably the one where I was very early. I guess I was right about the thesis, but I didn't execute it perfectly. Now, have I done poorly? No, but I could have done probably way better in paying more attention to. And the problem with these questions is that like hindsight is obviously 2020, but I think I probably should have realized during the ICO boom that like this sort of fat protocol thesis of like ETH at the end of the day is this capital formation machine and it will benefit a lot. Like, I'll tell you like a thesis that I got completely wrong and then I appreciate it maybe to give listeners another anecdote. But I think one of the bigger mistakes I did during the ICO boom was like investing in things that had way too many dependencies. Like, I think we're still in that state of crypto where like you're throwing kind of ideas at the wall to see what sticks. But like prediction markets can be huge, but probably can be very large over time. But like something like Augur never was going to work because you didn't have a stable coin. And then all these other ideas or during the ICO boom were never going to work because you didn't have DeFi. You didn't have a stable coin. And so that's a clear dependency, right? Or like NFTs, like you didn't have a network like Solana with super low fees. So NFTs at scale and mass are not going to work, or gaming is not going to work. So I do wonder like if my thesis on gaming was too early, even though I've done very well. We still don't have gaming, and maybe I should revisit my thesis because maybe it's GameFi. Like maybe it is just, it will just be financialization and then just a little bit more fun. But I wonder, that probably isn't as big enough of a market as I probably thought it would be. Again, this is an example of not an error of process. Actually, I got not an error of outcome. The outcome was exceptional, but the process was like, I think, pretty premature, pretty poorly executed. I think it's important to like go back and even you can have something like some of the gaming investments I've made. The outcome has been phenomenal, but the process not so much. Mm. Investments I made, I'm sure, like you too, but like, and those are probably the ones that I've tended to overlook the most. And after the ICO crash, I went back to those and said, okay, paying attention to those is important because that's where you like, you always focus on like the things you didn't do well. Like there's an error of outcome, and then naturally you diagnose the process, but it's the ones that you really do well that you tend to overlook. And there may be plenty of errors in that process, but the outcome might be great. And that's, I think, the difference between a good investor and a fantastic investor. I think that's where I've made the most amount of growth in my investing, I guess, style, is by focusing on like that other part that I tended to overlook.
There was you put this little random section. You said random thoughts and had some bullets. And there's one that says, on not being prepared for success. What does this one mean?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are afraid of being successful. Just fundamentally. I've seen money change people very quickly. And I think you can be afraid, right? Like, okay. I now seeing in the timeline, people are saying, oh, you know, my portfolio is at all time high, but I somehow feel the worst. It's not uncommon. And I think money can be incredibly liberating. It buys you time. It is the best thing in the world, I think. Because it allows you to, money is energy. But it's worthwhile investing in thinking what would happen if you were to all of a sudden wake up and you had the amount that you dream of. And questioning the things that come to mind first. And questioning if your identity is tied to a number. Mine was at some point. And it's not now.
How much has your happiness changed from cycle 1 to 2 to 3 to 4?
I think I'm quite happy, generally. It's improved, for sure. I'd be lying if I tell you that making more money did not make you happier. I think anyone that says that money contributes to it a lot. Like being I'll say this. Owning my time has been probably the biggest contributor to my happiness. Just that. And whatever that number is, it's very different. Because there's people that have a ton of money but don't own their time. So when I left Parify, it's like I've constantly revisited the idea of raising a fund. And I always shut it down because I know that will be not owning my time. You give up on that. And I don't miss it. And I think for me, owning my time is more important than adding another two zeros to my name or zero or whatever. What sometimes, I guess what would change is if I no longer feel relevant and whatever that may, but I feel fulfilled in what I'm doing. Crypto is important in my life. I think it's the biggest movement that I'll see in my life, but it doesn't, it's not everything for me. I have other interests. I do other things. I think about other things. A lot of them are more and more related and intertwined with crypto, but it's not everything. So I don't want to say I'll never do a fund or I'll never do things that will compromise a bit of my time. I think you always do some trade-off, right? Because it's like when you go on summer break in school, when you're taking that final exam, all you're thinking of is summer break. 2 weeks in, you want to go back to school. I haven't felt that because I'm doing other stuff. A lot of it is sitting here and doing Empire. I think it's been very rewarding. And I'll continue to do that. If there's a time where I don't feel relevant, maybe I'll go and launch a fund. But that day hasn't come.
There's this post from 2021 about 2 weeks away from the top, October 26, 2021. He said, I've made many mistakes investing over the years. One of the key learnings and insights has been not investing in things that have many dependencies. What did you mean by this?
Yeah, as I said earlier, like it was in the ICO boom, you had a lot of these projects that, like Augur, prediction market, you get excited about the category, you could truly define media, information, surfacing, wisdom of the crowds, yada, yada, yada. You rally behind that TAM, you rally behind that idea. But when you're settling bets and you don't have a stable coin, and you're settling on a volatile collateral like ETH, it's not going to work. This is why I'm so excited about Solana now. Which, by the way, I think for everyone, and so like that, something like a prediction market in 2018, or like Uber, or Airbnb on the, or AI today. Okay, let's talk about AI. People want to hear about AI. LLMs, all this jazz. Okay, fine. You know, great. I'm excited. Are you going to deploy that in Ethereum? What kind of, like, what is the cost? Can you actually upload your model? How expensive is that going to be? Bitcoin L2s. Oh, it's an L2. You know, it's a multi-sig. I'm like, yeah, good luck trying to convince core Bitcoin holders about that. There are dependencies. Like, they're thankfully, like, over the last 12 years, we've made meaningful improvements on the infrastructure side of things. DeFi has been a huge backbone to power all the other stuff, gaming, NFTs, and many of the other use cases. Like, DeFi is so essential. It's a reason why it's the first killer use case. Why I got so excited at ParaFi, and Ben thankfully shared that vision, is that it is the backbone for everything else. Because if this is a financialization and untethered capital markets at the speed of light, you need DeFi. And if you don't have a DeFi system in place, a core bank that allows you to mint collateral against it, like Maker or Compound or Aave, a lot of the other things don't work. And so there's a reason why, if you look at the evolution of every L1, every L2, Blast is an example, the first things that work are a DEX and a money market. And so that's what I mean by, like, you need, or like an Oracle. Like, these are kind of like core dependencies to power, to open up the, so whenever I look at something like AI today, I'm very excited, but at the same time, I do question when a founder says, yeah, I'm working on like, we're deploying an Ethereum. Like, okay, like, your model must be the size of, like, it's not going to work. And, so yeah. Now, is AI crypto not going to be a thing? No, I think it's going to be very much a thing in the right, with the right network. So yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. What is a mistake that happened that didn't seem to be meaningful at the time, but looking back, you think that it's a, you now realize that it was a big mistake?
Yeah, someone asked this question. It was a good question. It took me a while to respond. Yeah. So of course, it's a difficult question because the bias is to think, focus on the outcome, right? And not so much on the process. You know, obviously, naturally, like selling a particular position, maybe at the time didn't mean meaningful. Selling ETH at like 18 bucks didn't mean meaningful. It actually felt like a genius. I was up 40X. I'm like, Jesus, like, this is great. I've outperformed every venture fund out there. Now, of course, over time, that became incredibly stupid, right? That was an era of outcome, as I've talked about, but there are other instances where, like, sorry, an era of process. And so I think, like, when someone asks this question, the natural inclination is to think, I sold a bag that could have been 100X down the road, which, you know, I think you naturally have to think that you're going to make those mistakes. And it's going to happen. Like, you're not going to catch them all, right? And I think, like, obsessing about those is probably not so much of a useful exercise. I think the biggest mistake that didn't seem to be meaningful was, for so many years, I wasn't documenting my trades or being as disciplined as I was trained to be in my upbringing as an investor at JP Morgan and then at Sagemore. And I'm like, I know how to, there's like a process by which, like, an institutional process, like, as an investor, like, you're trained a certain way. And I was lucky because so many people invested their time. And I was like, why am I not doing this with my portfolio? Like, it's, and I think success, especially when you have it like in crypto, you can punt a lot of these deficiencies and you can probably get away with it for a long time. And then at some point it would just come and haunt you. If you really want to scale your book, if you really want to grow it and then manage it, these are some of the things that I would go back, and it didn't feel as meaningful at the time because you hit it once with Bitcoin, you hit it with Ethereum, and you're like, everything goes up like it is today. But I would highly encourage people to be disciplined with their process, to document it as much as possible. And if you ever feel so comfortable, to comment and open source that process publicly, because to invite criticism, because ultimately that someone else asks, like, where have you seen the highest growth? And for me, it was actually recently where I started being more vocal about my Solana thesis and inviting a lot of criticism naturally. Open sourcing that process was very useful for me to go back and saying, all right, I actually don't understand fee markets that well. Okay, I actually don't understand stuff that is happening outside of Solana. Like, yeah, Solana has a really good things, but actually there's some wrong things here. Like, there's things that are not perfect, not wrong, but they're not figured out. Okay, listen, let me focus on that. And I think this probably would have taken me months of work, whereas being vocal on Twitter, being vocal here, allowed me to connect with people because they reached out publicly or privately, and that was incredibly useful. So, yeah.
I've noticed you've gotten very transparent over the last year on Twitter. Yeah. How do you think about the pros and cons of posting on Twitter and oversharing, undersharing? And yeah, just how do you think about, like, transparency in general?
I have come... You're right. I become more comfortable being more transparent only and trying to speak from personal experience and trying to keep it to that. It's slightly sometimes uncomfortable. Like, I guess people want simple answers. You know, they want to be told what to buy and what to sell and when to sell. But that's like my biggest hesitation. So I don't know, like, I've liked doing it with Solana. I'm prepared to be incredibly wrong if it doesn't reach parity with Ethereum. But I think that, yeah, it's just now become a thing in my process. But it is, I don't know how you feel about it. It's very difficult because, I just recently funded this thing called Bit Club. The idea is to like share liquid stuff, like liquid ideas that I'm interested in. And I was talking to Jason, who's like spearheading this effort for Maple Folios. I was like, well, what if like you connected your wallet and people could see your wallet? I mean, OPSEC obviously is the reason why you wouldn't want to be as transparent with certain things. But if I talk about a particular project, like GeoNet, for instance, that I talked about, that I recently did a deal. It was OTC, but you know, the tokens are locked. I can't sell them for a year. Like, you know, people can go and buy them right now and dump them on me, whatever. Like, I can't touch them. In that case, I could maybe post the contract, the vesting contract or the wallet. People can see when I'm buying. If everyone does it, like, is that a bad thing? Like, that would be like a perfect real time 13F, right? Or something like that. Yeah, I don't know how you feel about it. I'm still uneasy about it, to be honest, because I can change my mind on things frequently. Maybe after this pod, I sell all my meme coins. Maybe, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe PsyOps. I don't know. my position is very different than others, and so is yours, and so whoever's listening. So, like, I think you have to. I'll say maybe the last thing that I haven't maybe emphasized as much in this is like everything that I've said here may not likely apply to you. There are certain principles that I really have found useful and I bring them up time and time again. I brought them on the last podcast, like this idea of thinking probabilities, constantly updating your thesis. Binary thinking doesn't serve you well. I think it's the most useful thing that I've applied in my process. It may not work for you. You may be a fantastic trader. You may have a magic crystal ball, whatever it is. But like, again, like the process is very unique to your style, your position. And, you know, I'd encourage, it's a very personal process. So I think the ultimate path is like when you make a mistake, it's like, denial, right? It's that phase, right? Denial, and then like anger, and then finally like acceptance, and then hopefully transcend. Maybe I'll leave you with this, but like we are going to make all mistakes constantly. You said it. Know the game you're playing. Never put yourself in a position where you can be out of the game. Never. If you love this game, zoom out, be here, increase your probability of being at bat. Don't be liquidated, you know, and play the long game. Like one of the more comforting things, you always have to find like places of comfort because it can be very stressful. Like it is stressful, right? So managing your emotional state for me, what that has given me the most amount of comfort is this idea that inverting, it's like, okay, I'm in my 30s. How many more years of investing do I have ahead of me? If things pan out health-wise, whatever, 40, 50? And I want to be there. I want to be in a position to back founders, to do what I love, because I love this game. If you don't love this game, go play another game. But I love this game. So I think for me, it's like, that has given me, when you ask me if I'm happier now, I'm happier now because I'm very comfortable that if I play this cycle right, I don't know, will I play the first cycle better than the third or the second or the fourth or the 10th? I don't know. But I want to be here for the next 30, 40, 50 years. And so, yeah, I'm just aware that the power of that compounding is something that I don't want to give up on.
Yeah.
Before I would have told you, I want to get to a certain number. I've been there and I want to get to 10 and then 100 and then a billion and then 10 billion. And it never fucking stops. But the most rewarding thing, literally the most rewarding thing that I've done is doing the podcast. like another 10x in the, it's like, it just doesn't compute as much as hearing a listen. And it may sound soft, but it's like hearing a listen say, hey man, like I was listening to Empire through the Bear and you guys really helped me like navigate this stuff on my own. It was great. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a grand ambition now?
Yes, very much so. I think people most of the time don't know what to do with money. And I'm always running. So, okay. Why haven't we sequenced the microbiome? Why is nuclear underfunded? The public sector is a terrible allocator of resources. Terrible. Even the private sector. I understand Piketty and you can be compounding and earning 5% on like billions and billions of dollars. And then you can go buy a private yacht for like 330 million bucks and spend 10% of your, you know, it pisses me off when I see that. Not to each his own, right? I'm not going to judge you. But I think there are very neglected pockets of this world that deserve money to do more research, to pursue their ideas. And it's a coordination problem. Crypto helps with coordination. I want to make more money because there are a lot of things that I want to pursue. Money is like a really high density thing. And the more, after a certain level, I think you start playing at a, like the chessboard and you can start moving pieces. Like when Bezos or Elon were deciding when to build their factory, a lot of states came to them and offered this crazy incentives. I think that's really powerful because you impact a lot of people and you have a lot of decision-making power. And so, yeah, that's nuclear and sequencing the microbiome for whatever. There are two ideas that I've had for a long time. I want to pursue them. It's going to take much more money, but it's like they're neglected, right? Think about like crypto is very neglected, contrarian still. Nuclear, you and I share this passion for it. So there's no reason why like it hasn't been, you know, why aren't we investing billions of dollars in nuclear? Why are we throwing away into fucking solar panels and winter, like that degrade in 3 years, not 10. And it costs more energy to produce than they'll ever make in their entire fucking life. It makes no sense. Like literally, it makes no sense. But here we are.
Yes, yeah, narrative problem. All right, man. This has been great. Any other last thoughts, words, lessons, mistakes that you want to share?
Maybe I've been talking for a long time. What is maybe one or two mistakes that you've, what's your worst mistake that you've done?
2017, I bought a bunch of ETH on credit cards.
You get a lot of points.
Send all that ETH over to my Ether wallet, load it up on some ICOs. One out of 20 ended up working, which was Chainlink. And then had big old bag of credit card debt right as we were launching Blockworks. I'd like maxed out like 3 credit cards. So that.
Wait, you know. Then what happened though? You were forced to sell?
I just ate like, I think it was 24% APR, you know, 20% APR, just ate that for years or not years, but you know, for a long time paying that off basically and just paid it off month by month. But you know, that was,
and there wasn't yield farming back then to make that carry trade.
No. And Mike and I at the beginning of Blockworks paid ourselves like the minimum wage of New York basically. And you know, in 2019, when the bear market got really bad, we stopped paying ourselves. And that was like 3 years into the business. We literally cut our salary. We cut our pay to zero. And you know, but I had credit card debt. And so that, you know, that was definitely tough. That was a hanging mistake that lasted for a while. That was one. Another one was probably, you know, we did things at Blockworks that I don't know if there are mistakes, but, We chased, because we were bootstrapped, we thought we had to chase short-term cash, and we probably over-optimized for that. So we did things like, you know, we hosted the Multicoin Summit in 2019.
Oh, yeah, I remember like, that.
Multicoin at Half Moon Bay? What?
At Half Moon Bay?
No, the one at Cipriani in New York in 2019. Oh. So, like, oh, okay. They hired Blockworks to host the Multicoin Summit. that's not the game we're playing. That like that's an outsourced event services business.
Yeah, you're
like,
not an events coordinator. You're a media.
No, company. Like that's not our business. But we did things like that. You know, we in 2019, I think it was, or 2020, we like basically started a influencer marketing agency on the side we literally almost hired a head of influencer business to like, we had 300 people on this spreadsheet. I won't name names, but like, you know, BlockFi would come to us and be like,
hey, guarantee you I was not there in that list.
The first time I think I ever messaged you was to see if you wanted to get on and you didn't even respond to me. I'm pretty sure. But we'll have to check the chain, check the DMs. But
as far as I remember, you shot down my idea to do a DeFi pod. Right.
Oh, that was the first time we talked. Yeah. That was the first time. So anyways, there was another mistake that we made was like not investing in content, our own content, or not taking a bet on ourselves. So the early Blockworks business, we would go host podcasts for other people, right? Pomp and Selkis, Meltem Demirs and Joel Carlson, Charlie Shrem, Wolf of Wall Street. We had all these outside shows. We had to literally start over in March of 2021. When we launched Empire, that was the first time we'd ever created an in-house show that we owned. And so that was 3.5 years of building where we had built other people's shows. And it was great because it allowed us to bootstrap the business. And those shows spit off, you know, lots and lots of money. And a lot of those shows made millions of dollars a year. But we had no leverage and we didn't own the IP. So we had to basically start fresh. So we did a lot of those kind of things to where we were kind of chasing the dollar, not understanding the business value that we were creating. Those are some of the ones that come to mind. Hiring from big, this is probably one that a lot of founders are going to make this cycle, but from big name companies, right? We've hired from basically any time we've hired from a big TradFi company, it doesn't work. Like,
I think that's the data is very compelling, like for most organizations, right?
Yeah. I mean, you want to kind of think about the next level of your company and maybe hire there. But when you hire like seven steps ahead, it doesn't work. So let's say, Blockworks has 60 employees right now. When I'm hiring, I am trying to think about people who, you know, have built companies from 50 to 100 people or are, you know, head of functions at 100 and 150 person companies. But when you hire, you know, if we went and hired the head of sales from Bloomberg, right, that's a 100,000 person company with, you know, the Bloomberg brand on it. It's literally a different life that this person is living. So yeah, that's a mistake that we've made a couple of times and have learned the hard way over and over again.
I think crypto is a great training ground. I think I'll close out by saying you should be making mistakes. If you're not making mistakes, you're not taking enough risk. You're not putting yourself out there. Like the best investors, the wealthiest people in the world, I know it's cliche, but a lot of them have nearly bankrupt on certain things, decisions that they've made. I think you never want to put yourself in a position of being as close to absolute like liquidation or whatnot, but it's normal. Like you should be taking those. And the faster you put ego aside, you recognize the quote unquote mistake and you learn from it, you document it. Like that's the process that you want to get into, I think. And minimize ego, recognize your emotions, but minimize ego. You know, you're never going to time it perfectly. And so at the end of the day, like, you know, live to see another day, be here, like take at bats, take swings, right? And, you know, some of them might work out, others may not. But I have a ton of respect when I hear someone like Stan, like admiration, really not respect. There's someone like Stan Druckenmiller. And I'll say it's time and time again. So it's just incredible to hear someone like that after his incredible track record. He goes on public television and says, I don't know what I'm doing right now because this market, this conditions, I've never experienced in my life. I was like, wow. But meanwhile, you hear like all the other guys that are not as successful be like, they know certain things. They speak from authority and in binary terms. And you just tell what's going on in Stan's brain. The dark of those games, like he's thinking in probabilities and hedging and constantly adapting his thinking. And I think it'd be weird not to do that in crypto, right? So when you ask me, I think you always have to have a point where you really change, you do something if it reaches a certain level, because who knows, man, like the probability of Ethereum going to zero is still not zero. Of it maintaining its lead is still, you know, none of this is figured out, right? And so I think we all can rest on the conviction that crypto is here to stay. It has less existential risk. It's very powerful. It's woken up. It's opened up this box. It's opened a door to fix a lot of things. But it may not be Solana. It may not be Ethereum. It may not be Bitcoin. Maybe something that doesn't even exist. But I think your probability of catching and investing in these things is going to be much, much higher if you perfect your process as much as possible. Yeah. Don't beat yourself too much. I mean, I think that's the other thing, man. When you make these mistakes, it's like, it's really you that's your worst enemy. You're beating yourself up as much as possible. I'd highly encourage the key takeaway for me is therapy's been some of the best investment I've made.
And exercise. I will say my mental health in this cycle compared to last cycle is night and day. And it's because of
exercise.
Yeah, get, you know, heavy lifting, I would say, for me. I talked to Tolly about this. He's trying to hit the 1,000 club. I'm trying to hit the 800, so yeah. Yeah. He's got a few years on me, but
nice.
Yeah. I can't run. I can't run. I got these long, lanky legs.
Yeah. 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 That's why you're so critical of me running marathons and stuff.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate you sharing.
Yeah. Hopefully it was useful. If anything, it'll be useful for me because I'll go listen to this again and again and be like, oh God, why did I say that? I'm so stupid. So maybe this was a whole mistake, or maybe it was the best thing that I've ever done. Who knows?
Yeah. Time will tell. That was great. To end, as we always end on the content side of things. So I recommended Avatar on the last episode. I would like to formally offer an apology to anyone who has actually watched that show, because I watched a few episodes, few more episodes, and it is a god awful show.
Corrected mistake. Good work.
I was watching like episodes 2 and 3, and the only reason I kept watching is I was like, I recommended this publicly. There's really an investing lesson here. I was like, I recommended this publicly, so I have to keep watching. Right. And then I was like, you know, I have to offer this formal apology, because man, that is some bad acting in that show. So
I heard Shogun is really good, inspired by the novel for Jace Clavell, which is one of my favorite. It's on Disney Plus.
I'm watching it on Hulu, so I'm an episode and a half in. But
is it good?
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. Okay. Someone recommended it. Mert said the best show of all time or something.
Mert's now obsessed with Japanese culture. He's been going on this like deep dive.
I'm pretty sure Mert watched one episode of Shogun. Thought Japanese culture is like the coolest thing in the world. No, I don't know. I have no idea about Mert's affiliation with Japan. But anyways, it's a pretty good show. It's a pretty good show.
All right. Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, always a treat. Thanks for allowing me to share these things. And you know, if people want to hear about more in particular, you know, drop us a comment. And make sure to call me out if I'm rambling, whoever you are.
Can't wait to see the YouTube comments after this. All right, thanks everyone. See you next week. Thank you. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to today's episode. Don't forget to claim your free Wormhole NFT exclusive to Empire listeners. Hit the link in the description of today's episode and fill out the form to claim your unique Wormhole NFT today.